Thanks. So the work I'm going to speak about, and we did in Montpellier in the last few years, is that is we tried to extend the problematic of shear banding to other systems than, for example, giant micelles. And the systems, the title of my talk is Shear Banding in Ordered Mesophases. And the kind of system I will discuss are typically soft crystals. So I'll try to see how you can extend the problematic of shear banding into dense systems, systems which have a local crystalline order, but are also disordered in the sense that they are polycrystalline on a larger scale. And so they are pasty systems, and I'll try to address the problem, how can these kind of systems manage to localize the deformation under stress, for example, and what, how can you correlate this to the problems of shear banding people have been studying. So these are the people involved. A lot of the rheology I will discuss and the structure under X-rays was made on the cubic phase. I will discuss two cubic phases. Was made when Erika Eiser, now in Amsterdam, was postdoc in our lab. And Laurence Ramos introduced us to a soft hexagonal phase she's been studying during her PhD in Collège de France. The whole study of these soft crystals was begun by Grégoire Porte and Jean-François Béret when they studied the static structure of the first crystal back in 94, 95, I think. And Olivier Bia and Peter Lindner were the one who developed at ILL and ESRF tools which enabled us to study the structure under flow, under neutron and X-rays. Xavier Piton was a graduate student who did some more rheology, and I was involved more or less in all these studies from the beginning. Okay, so to begin with, I will try to give a very sketchy, very short introduction of what, not what is shear banding, but the idea of shear banding we had in mind back in 95 when we began to investigate this soft phases. I will take a simplified version of a canonical example, giant micelles. And you know what giant micelles are. They are long cylindrical aggregates of surfactant molecules. And if you increase the concentration, you can go to a semi-dilute regime and obtain a viscoelastic fluid. And if you plot, and if you do the measurement of the stress versus shear rate for the system, so you have hit for dip, you have, here you have the result for different temperature, just follow one of the curves. Basically, the basic phenomenon you get is you have something like a simple fluid, viscous fluid, perhaps a bit shear thinning. Jean-François will discuss in more detail next week what people think about now about these systems. But the important point is that you have a rather abrupt beginning of a strong shear thinning behavior, which manifests itself as the beginning of a plateau in stress. And in this plateau, the systems show a drop of typically one or two orders of magnitude in viscosity. So you have this rather dramatic event, this rather dramatic beginning of the shear thinning, of the violent shear thinning behavior. And the important point is that people have been able to roughly correlate this with structural changes in the system, and these also are data from Jean-François. Basically, if you look in this region of violent shear thinning and you observe the system of giant micelles in birefringence, what you observe in the plateau, at the beginning of the plateau, is the apparition of a part of the sample which is strongly, in which the micelles are strongly aligned. In configuration, you expect to be far less viscous than the original viscoelastic fluid. And when you go along the plateau, you observe the growth of this this band of strongly aligned micelles up to the end of the plateau, where the band almost fills the whole gap. So this is a very sketchy version, because we were thinking in these terms back in 95, that is, thinking of only two bands, one strongly aligned with a sharp interface, and on the other side, the same or slightly aligned viscoelastic fluid. I think people now are getting a far more complicated vision of what's going on, but the idea was that this band was far more fluid than the previous one, and so the effective viscosity you measure in this plateau is just some kind of combination of this very low viscosity and the original viscosity, and basically the drop in viscosity you observe here is related to the growth of the fluid phase. And we had in mind a very simple version when we began trying to transport this point of view on more dense phases. So I will turn now, starting from this sketch view of shear thinning, I'll first describe you the first system I want to discuss, which is a soft cubic crystal of triblock copolymers in water. So to make this system, we use the fact that water can be as a property of selective solvent concerning the different parts of a triblock PEO, PPO, PEO polymer. That is, if you dissolve this polymer at 5 degrees Celsius in water, it completely dissolves and you obtain a viscous fluid. If you raise the temperature to room temperature, the PPO part becomes slightly hydrophobic and you obtain aggregation into micelles of fixed aggregation number. And if you now, and the number, the aggregation number and the size of the micelles depends on the relative length of the arms and the core of your so-called pleuronic commercial polymer. So we have investigated two systems, and you have some kind of, here it's a very simplified phase diagram. Basically here is a concentration in polymer, and here's a temperature. And when you increase the temperature, you create your micelles, and if you are at a high enough concentration, the repulsion between the micelles promotes crystallization of the sample. And Jean-François and Grégoire made X-rays in this region for these two systems, and they were able to demonstrate that you have a local FCC or BCC order according for two different polymers. So basically what you get, and I will not discuss in details the phase diagram, which has been extensively studied by Mortensen group, by Alice Gast also, and the details of the rather complicated interactions that you can, how can you model the interaction between micelles? It's not very clear for me, but we take for granted that in a given region of the phase diagram, we have a crystal of subspheres stacked in a given local symmetry, which is FCC or BCC. So basically what you do, and what you, in all the experiments I will describe, is you pour your system at 5 degrees into the Couette cell, you rise the temperature, you create your gel, which is a polycrystal, local crystalline order, but disorder on a larger scale, and then you begin your rheology or structure experiments, okay? And of course, although the symmetry is the same as for metal, this is soft matter. The typical distance between micelles is typically 100 times larger than in metal, so you expect roughly the elastic modulus or things like that to be a million times softer. Something like the cube, the inverse of the cube at the typical distance. And these two systems are just transparent gels. I mean, we have something in France called a Fête de la Science, in which we meet the public, and I brought some of the samples. It's quite funny to show that to people, because you put it in the fridge, it becomes liquid. You get it out, and half an hour after, you have a ringing gel. Ping, you can make fancy experiments, and a little child put its finger inside it, and the mark is still here, is still there 3 years after. So it's a solid, and you expect things like yield stress, and I will discuss this in more details. Okay, so first, we are looking for shear banding. So first experiment, trying to obtain the flow curve. I will discuss a little bit afterwards how do we obtain these points here. You see we have very slow value for shear rate here. So basically this curve was obtained under constant stress, taking care of the transient and taking care that we have a real steady state shear rate. And you see at first sight that for this experiment you have precisely the kind of shear thinning behavior you are expecting. We want to see that is between a value somewhere around 1 or 2 second minus 1 to 100, you have a violent shear thinning behavior and separating two branches in which the system behave in a more... No, I will discuss this point. We were not able to measure the yield stress, and I will come back to this, okay? So, from this very simple, from this data, we first go to the SRF and try to see what the structure is in the different regions. This is a rapid sketch of the kind of geometry we're using at SRF and ELL, Couette cell, and we can send the beam either through the axis of the Couette or through the gap. So the direction of the beam can be in the direction of the velocity gradient or in the direction of the velocity, and we can even scan the gap here with the X-rays, especially with the X-rays. Okay, and on this first slide of the structure, I will show the structure taken in the radial direction. So you have your Couette and you go straight through the Couette. You know that you have prepared your sample in a polycrystalline state at a zero shear rate, and you're not surprised to find that in this whole region you keep your rings of the polycrystalline order. Okay. And on the contrary, if you go to very high shear rates in the third region of the curve, you observe something entirely different. You have ordered on a macroscopic scale, this crystal, and you can identify these Miller planes as being the dense planes of your BCC crystal. This is a beautiful sketch from Erika. The planes I'm speaking about are these planes in the BCC, the diagonal planes, and what you see in this third organization, that all these planes are stacked together in front of you, parallel to the quartz walls. And if you manage, if you look what's happening between these two extreme cases, you get the impression that you can observe some kind of coexistence between the ordered structure and the polycrystal. These beautiful shots are taken at rest after cessation of the shear. I give this as detail because these are very sharp peaks. Basically, if you take the picture under shear, you obtain peaks which are in the same position but a little bit more fuzzy. Just want to mention it. And so to analyze the data, we in general analyze data which are taken at rest immediately after cessation of the shear. So in the intermediate region, you get the impression that you can monitor the superposition between this organization and the initial polycrystal. And this is confirmed if you go in the tangential direction and you scan the gap, and you can see the coexistence between the two kinds of organization. And this is quite well known. It's been studied in colloidal crystal by Ackerson and Clark in the 80s. Alice Gast has done the same kind of experiments. This is a so-called layer sliding mechanism. And the picture is as follows. You have your initial polycrystal, and the system flows for the low shear rates in somewhat homogeneous way. And at a given stress or shear rate, you have the beginning of the creation of this layer sliding regime, in which I have represented here a sketch of the dense planes, of the dense 110 planes I was showing there of the crystal. They are sliding past each other, with the most dense direction in terms of spheres being aligned with the velocity. Okay? So this is, in fact, this is not completely surprising. This has been studied by people, and at this stage, we seem to have quite a beautiful picture of the way we can transport the problems of shear banding into a dense system. We know what the fluid phase is. It's quite natural to think that this organization of layers sliding past each other is more fluid than an initial polycrystal, and we have a good correlation between the structural and rheological data. Now, things that I want to discuss a little bit more in detail are also related to a question that was asked to me before. I would like to address two points. First, can we understand the way in which the crystal flows in this first part of the curve? First point. And second point, can we understand what happens at this particular stress or shear rate to be the beginning of the shear banding and the first apparition of the very fluid phase? So I will first concentrate on understanding what's going on in this first region of the flow curve. I must keep this. Okay, and I want to describe the kind of transient experiments we are doing on this system. In fact, what we're doing is basically what people in metallurgy are doing to their samples. We submit it to a constant stress and observe the strain as a function of time. That's not a very usual way of measuring moduli, but in fact, it gives us a rather good results. And the two questions we can obtain main information from these kind of curves. We have an instantaneous elastic response, a creep part of the curve, and when you switch off the stress, you have an elastic recovery and a delayed recovery. And if you want to think very simply about this, you can imagine that you have a Maxwell element and a Voigt element after. And when you put a load on it, you first act on the spring, then the Voigt element begin also to be loaded, and you have some flow due to the viscous part. And when you unload it, the spring of the Maxwell element unload, and then the Voigt element unload in a delayed way. Right? This do not really fit the data. It's more complicated, but that's a sketchy way of seeing that. So we can basically, the kind of question we are going to ask you, we can determine from this initial jump the elastic modulus. This is quite easy. So we just plot the value of the jump as a function of the stress, and we obtain an elastic modulus, which is around 40,000 Pascal. And because this way of measuring the modulus is not completely usual, we perform from elementary oscillatory rheology, and we work, so this is G prime to double prime, in a rather limited range of frequencies, and we can be assured that we are rather in the same ballpark for the value of the modulus. I will come back to this. Okay. And the second thing we can ask is this system... Sorry?
There is a second order difference between your substance and a typical metal. In a metal, the shear modulus is about 10 to the 11th.
Yes, so yes, that's what you would expect. Because, as I said at the beginning, the distance between the elementary objects is two orders of magnitude more. So if you take the cube, it's six orders. So that's roughly what you would expect, in fact. And the second question is the system going to achieve a steady state? Are we going to achieve a constant slope at a given moment? And the answer is yes. And this is related to your question. Even for very small stresses of 1 pascal, we are... Of course, if you look locally, it looks a little bit stick-slip. But if you wait 1 hour, you have a beautiful slope. And you can extract a constant shear rate, which is very small. But we were confident that this slope had meaning. And this one are the slopes I plotted in my at the very leftmost part of this curve. About? Yes, absolutely. And this is a point I don't understand. But perhaps it is below 1 pascal, I don't know. Yeah. But I agree. I mean, there's this question, is there a yield stress or not? Yeah, definitely you're right, yes. I agree.
So, similar experiments like melt VCC melts with the Redwood register. If you see something quite different, I'm just curious if you ever saw the same thing. Rather than forming layer sliding, this block of polymer melts from melt. That is, when you apply shear.
Shear melting.
Yeah. When he does scattering, he gets a liquid-like structure.
Yeah. And we were looking for that, but we didn't find it. I mean, at high shear rates, you can expect to melt everything. But on the shear rates we're investigating here, you have no melting. Okay. But in fact, people were, back in 95, people were quite interested in this shear melting problem. And in fact, it was one of the things we've tried to find, but okay. Okay. So. Basic idea is this system flows for extremely slow stresses. And if you go to the metallurgy literature, you have this rough estimate of, oh, the question is, how can a crystal flow? That's a very simple argument in the first pages of any books on the creep of crystals. The first simple argument is that you take a Miller plane, and you try to estimate the yield strength of going above to the next valley in your periodic potential. So you take your wall plane and schluck, you move to the next valley. And there is a number people have cooked up to estimate the strength you need to do that. And it is around the elastic modulus divided by 30 from different arguments. And of course, in metals, people have been observing that metals at high temperature can creep to applied stresses which are 5 orders of magnitude below this value. And of course, this is the reason people introduced dislocations in the first place, because people realized that you just could not make your crystal creep just by moving the wall layers. And of course, we think that in our crystal, dislocations are, at these very small stresses, the basic ingredient of the flow. So we were rather ignorant of dislocation and all that. So I give you a first, a very sketchy view of how one dislocation, in this example, a screw dislocation, promotes a shear of a structure. So when this dislocation, you imagine vertical line of dislocation, moves from this place to this place, it opens like that. That is, this block is sheared in this direction comparatively to this one. Okay. So by glide of dislocations, you can promote, and of course, this corresponds to a very localized deformation of the compared to the wall movement of a wall Miller plane above another. And so the question is, are people able to predict something concerning the flow curve from this mechanism? And it is the case. And there is a mechanism due to OR1, which I try to summarize in this slide, which predicts a gamma dot 1/3 behavior for a creep or a flow of crystal mediated by dislocation. And here is a rough argument. Imagine that the typical distance between dislocation xi. OR1's argument goes in three ways. So there is a geometrical argument in which you say the effective shear rate will be, so imagine that to displace the upper part of this xi over xi box, respective to this one, you need of a distance b, the Burgers vector of the dislocation, you need to move the dislocation from the on the wall distance. When the dislocation has finished to move, you have displaced this block with respect to this one of b. So the effective shear will be b over xi. And the time it takes, the inverse time, will be v divided by xi. So the gamma dot, the OR1's formula for gamma dot is bv over xi squared. And now the argument goes as follows. You're going to show that v and 1 over xi both scales as with your applied stress. So you say that in your sample, you have an elastic viscous stress and an elastic stress, which are balancing each other. And and both scales with your applied stress. So the velocity via mobility, your velocity scales with the applied stress. And if you do an elastic argument, which is the applied stress score scales also with the elastic modulus times the deformation b over xi. Okay? So if you mix all things together, you have one VEC, one V here, and two xi here. So it goes like gamma dot goes as sigma third, this one and this one. And sigma goes as gamma dot 1/3 from this argument. And it works quite well, in fact. If you take the lower part of our curve and you try to adjust it with its gamma dot 0.3, you seem to have a reasonable, given that the argument is quite crude, you're quite surprised that you can describe so well the data with this low. So we think we can reasonably argue that in the low stresses, low shear rates regime, the lower part of the branch of the flow curve, we have a dislocation-mediated flow in the polycrystal. Well, not very much. Not the same. Not so much. No. It's better with 0.3. But you know. Okay. Because it doesn't scale so well with 0.33, that's all. So,
Another comment on the relationship of registers.
Yeah, okay.
Since the heat is able to lower the stress sufficiently so that you eventually see the linear response.
Okay.
Whereas you would have no true linear response.
That is, yeah, okay. 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 Hmm. But what stresses? In what region of stress? Okay. So. Okay. So now the second point I'd like to address is what's going on exactly when you go from this part of the flow curve to the plateau? And from experience in giant micelles, we first, which was quite naive perhaps, to find if there was some kind of relaxation time related to this point. Because in giant micelles, you expect something like gamma dot times tau, roughly equal to 1, to be a point where something happens when you couple your shear rate to an internal relaxation. And if you see it's around a few second minus 1, and if you look at this curve, you see something which is interesting at low frequencies, that I will not comment, and I should have erased this, because this is worthy of further studies. This is, of course, this is a dense, pasty, disordered material. It's a polycrystal. So, in fact, I erase the data here, but we observe this kind of G double prime increase at low frequencies. But perhaps I'd be happy to discuss that with some people interested. But let's say that we did the experiments mainly to see if at frequencies around the one in which gamma dots around the one in which we observe the beginning of the plateau, we see anything. And basically, there's nothing really interesting in terms of relaxations. But if you come back to this curve, there's another very simple argument. I mentioned before that there is this number of the elastic modulus divided by 30, which can be the typical stress for which you expect the planes to be able to move past each other without the help of dislocation. And for 40,000 divided by 30, you come up approximately in this region. You come up approximately to 1,300, and we observe there's a transition at 1,400. So we can argue that perhaps the beginning of the transition to shear bending is a moment when the system is able to make the Miller planes flow past each other without the help of dislocations in this system. And of course, it's well known from metallurgy that there are some preferential planes for that. And if you look at the metals, the BCC metals, you have three kinds of planes which are preferential, which are, of course, the more dense planes, 110, but also two other families, the 211 and the 123 planes. And this was quite helpful for us because, in fact, looking more closely on, let me show first the structural data again. In fact, looking more closely on this figure at intermediate shear rates, we are not able to analyze this as a superposition of this and this. These are the 110 planes sliding, but this one is not just a superposition of 110 and the polycrystal. And in fact, you have another structure mixing. And this structure, you can interpret it as being precisely the 211 plane sliding in front of you. So we interpret these data as being the coexistence of three different structures in the quad cell, which is possible due to inhomogeneity of the stress in the quad cell. And coming back to this beautiful sketch of Erika, that we have somewhere. Yes, this is the sketch we have. Here I have represented, she has represented the 110 planes, and this is the initial polycrystal. This is the last configuration with the 110 planes aligned with the quad walls. And this is an intermediate situation in which the 211 planes are are parallel to the quad walls. And in this case, in fact, the 110 planes are just perpendicular to the direction of vorticity. And of course, as I said, since the stress is inhomogeneous, if the difference between the strength, the typical stress to achieve this first layer sliding mechanism is very near to this one, you will have the stress structure in your quad cell. So we came back to Conan plate, because in Conan plate, you could expect to have a constant stress, and experiments in Conan plate in this system are quite difficult, because basically when the system becomes fluid, everything breaks down, so you will never be able to reach the second branch. And it's not very easy to reproduce these curves. But we have achieved in a number of experiments the observation of two plateaus. So, and for a range of shear rates, we correspond quite nicely to the range in which we observe the superposition of the peaks we have interpreted as being associated with the 211 layer sliding, and here's the coexistence of the 211, so the 211 with the polycrystal, and here the 211 with the 110. So we think that we can argue that there are two transitions in this system, and which nicely coincide with the slip planes, which are in metallurgy interpreted for, which are accounting for the slip in metals, two of the three planes which are used in metals to account for the slipping of the polycrystals. Okay. Sorry?
The number 30.
Yes. Well, I mean,
well, orientation?
Yes, it depends on the plane, of course. For different planes, it's different. Basically, what I would expect. I think, this number 30, I've always seen it mentioned, but without details. What I intuitively expect is that the Miller planes with either index are the further apart, so this will be the plane for which it will be the easier So I suspect it will be in this direction, but I'm not yet familiar enough with the literature on metallurgy to argue about that, about this number.
And it seems to be very important that we use a linear scale for measure to see that there are two.
Yeah. That's the reason why. That's the reason why in quad cell you see nothing, because you average everything in the quad cell. Okay, and just a last point. I've sketched here what the shear planes look like in the two different organizations. And what you see is that in both cases, the direction of the more dense direction for the spheres is always aligned with the velocity. So it's a rotation of your crystal around a direction which is always aligned with the velocity, and which is the direction of for which the spheres are more dense in the crystal. Okay. This one? No, it's a control. It's a control stress. This one. Okay. So I'm done for the BCC phase. So I think we have. Coming to metallurgy and arguing from dislocations movement, we have come to a qualitative understanding of what's going on in these crystals. And what I want to do in the next part of the talk is to develop the same arguments for another system which do not have the same symmetry, which is an hexagonal phase of soft cylinders underflow. And this system was brought to us by Laurence Ramos when she incorporated a CNRS in Montpellier after doing her PhD in Collège de France. And in her PhD, she developed this system, which is, you start basically for a conventional hexagonal phase of surfactants in water, and you add oil and salt to screen the interactions and to adjust the spontaneous curvature of the layer. And you are in this way able to swell cylinders between 1.5 and 17 nanometers. So you can obtain extremely soft hexagonal phases. And the typical moduli are one order of magnitude lower than for the previous system I was discussing. Okay? So you imagine you have now a polycrystal of stacked cylinders in hexagonal symmetry. And we are doing basically the same kind of experiments, creep experiments, and again the system will flow for all applied stresses. This is a typical creep curve, loading and unloading. From the initial elastic response versus the stress, you obtain elastic moduli. And we have, interestingly enough, we obtained a scaling that we found non-trivial. I will not discuss this further, but we obtained a scaling of the elastic modulus with the radius in one of our air cube, which was not completely trivial. And we more or less cooked up an explanation in terms of Elfrisch curvature of the, but this point took us some time to study, but basically, important point that elastic moduli are one order of magnitude lower, and we still have a crystalline, an elastic polycrystal, let's say. So, as you can expect, we're going to try to obtain the flow curve. Okay, this is a part of the flow curve. In fact, it extends farther in the left direction. Okay, what are the comments to be made? First, at the low rates, so here you have two kinds of experiments, control stress, the red lines, and control shear rate, that I do not trust too much, well, the blue crosses. Two important points. For low rates, we again come up with the gamma dot one-third low. And since all one's argument is not really dependent on the symmetry of the crystal, we basically argue in the same way, that this system is flowing due to movement of dislocations in the solid direction. So, well, it was not trivial for us to imagine why the system was obliged to move in the solid-like direction, but this gamma dot one-third low seems to indicate that dislocation movements in the solid planes are important for the flow. Then, at the high shear rate, you have a second stable branch, which can be described, and I will not comment on that. But by the way, this kind of flow is also true for the cubic phase, but I have no explanation for this kind of behavior. It's kind of Bingham behavior with some kind of yield stress plus a viscosity times the shear rate. And at intermediate shear rate, you obtain something in the geological curve, which is basically dependent on the history of what you've done to the system. When you go up from the polycrystal, you go up this way, and you came down and stressed, you came down this way. And we have tried to wait a very long time to be sure that this was a true hysteresis. That is, going down, we waited for hours here to see if the system was not going spontaneously to go to this. And perhaps we didn't wait long enough, but we're never able to reduce this hysteresis curve to a single plateau. Sorry? Quick. This is quick. And basically, you have in this region the same kind of drop of viscosity in this region of the hysteresis loop. You have this drop of viscosity that you associate with violent shear thinning. You lose between there and there one order of magnitude in effective viscosity. And so you go to the SRF for a few more nights. And okay. What is shown here, though, perhaps the geometry is not very clearly indicated in this one. So these three spectra are taken in the radial direction. So you look, your beam is going through the center of the quet, and when you start your experiment, you have the rings of the polycrystal of the hexagonal phase. And when you shear it, something not very surprising at the low shear rates is happening, that you strongly align the polycrystal with the flow. So this is an enhancement of this part of the first ring of the polycrystal, okay? So at low shear rates, you've got an alignment of the cylinders, basically, with the velocity. So the cylinders are aligned like this, and so you have an enhancement of the scattering in these directions. This is a velocity direction, and this is a vorticity direction. And if you got very high shear rates, you have something quite different. You have only one spot, so the cylinders are now dramatically aligned, with even far more aligned than in the initial polycrystalline state. And at intermediate shear rates, you seem to observe some kind of coexistence between this curve, this banner-like shape, and this dot. The coexistence for this system is a little bit more difficult to establish. I show you another spectrum, which goes in the same direction of coexistence between a new organization here and the polycrystalline here. This spectra was taken in the gap. So in the tangential direction through this. So in the tangential direction in the quet, so with the beam in the direction of the velocity. And after you stop the shear in the intermediate region. And what you see is the coexistence between two things, a polycrystal and a strongly aligned perfect monocrystal of hexagonal symmetry. So if you want to argue in terms of two organization, you have your polycrystal and something which, when you stop the shear, crystallize immediately in a strongly aligned hexagonal system. And looking at the structural data under shear, at high shear rate, you realize that, in fact, what you have done in the new lubricating organization in the fluid phase, corresponding to the drop in viscosity, you have the hexagonal phase is completely molten. You have, instead of the peaks, so this is the omega direction, so this is the radial direction, this is the tangential direction. This enforcement is due to the geometry of the quet, because you are averaging other different directions. And basically what you have is, in these directions, the cylinders being aligned with the velocity, you expect, if you have a perfect monocrystal, you expect to have this. That is, you see your cylinders in the direction of the velocity as an hexagonal structure. And under shear, at high shear rates, you have molten hexagonal phase. And if you stop the shear, in fact, it instantaneously recrystallizes in a perfect hexagonal monocrystal of the size of the gap. Okay? And the size of the beam compared to the size of the gap? I think we were able to scan the gap. You can obtain, let's say, 10 or 15 different positions in the gap. So let's say it's, I don't know. Yeah. This one is from the middle of the gap. Yes. Okay, but in high shear, you don't have any coexistence. Even if there is coexistence at intermediate shear rates, which is not completely sure in this system, at high shear, it's quite clear that you have molten your hexagonal face in the wall gap. Okay. So, and so, that's the reason why you have this dissymmetric spectrum with enforcement here and here. Okay. Okay, so this goes well in the same direction as we argued for the cubic phase, and we argued for the gamma dot one-third low in the low gamma dot region of this hexagonal phase. It is well known that you can promote the melting of an hexagonal phase through the proliferation of dislocations. This is a mechanism which has been studied by people to study two-dimensional melting, and we think that these data on the melting of the hexagonal phase goes in the same direction, and more specifically, we are able, a thing which we did not do very properly for the cubic phase, to monitor the width of the rings of the polycrystal in the low shear rate part of the curve. And if you interpret the width as some inverse distance, some typical either crystallite size or typical distance between dislocation, average distance between dislocations, the old ones low predicts that this distance should go as gamma dot one-third. Because as you remember, for the old ones low, you have the stress scaling as gamma dot one-third. So, and it works quite well. You have this delta Q over Q scaling at gamma dot one-third, and the distance going with the inverse of that. So we think that all these data, cleanly gathered together to suggest that in the low branch, dislocations are proliferating up to the point where the system begins to melt. And it remains a somewhat open question to be sure that we have coexistence between the molten and the polycrystalline part. This is not clear. But at this point, we think it is the case, but let's say that the only thing we are convinced of is that this proliferation of dislocation in these soft crystals plays a crucial role in the part of the curve before the transition to shear banding. And it remains an open question to know exactly how this dislocation proliferation leads to the nucleation of the first fluid band of the aligned or molten configurations. Okay. So that's all for this hexagonal phase. Now, yes?
In the hexagonal phase, it's obviously an easy direction because it requires flow.
Yeah. And it's quite puzzling for me. I mean, you could imagine that the system quietly adjusts to have its liquid direction with the velocity, and that's it. Why does the system melt? And when you think about it, it's perhaps possible to, it's very difficult to have your cylinders whirling along one line of velocity. You have cylinders doing, let's say you have slip planes, it's very difficult to imagine that you don't have cylinders doing that, switching from one shear plane to another from time to time. And this will cost a lot, because it means you have one cylinder which is shear at different velocities. And what about this? How is the system going to relax this? That's not easy. So. I mean, you speak in terms of instability due to the. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Then. Yeah. For the melt? Yes, a few hundred. Let's see. Yeah, when you begin to melt here, in applied stress, it happens at 100, around 100 second minus one. For the cubic phase, yeah. or two orders of magnitude, I don't remember. Yes, it's almost two orders of magnitude below. It's around more 1 second minus one. I don't have the two orders of magnitude below, I think. Yeah. You see, it's around a few second minus one. Okay. And to conclude, I want to discuss a last system coming back to a cubic phase, which in fact is the first system we ever studied for this shear banding transition in crystals. It's the FCC1. So I lost my slides. Okay. So I'm coming back to the kind of pleuronic system I first discussed. This. Exactly. Got it. And this time, I'm studying the FCC1. Okay, so this is a very simple crystal of stacked hexagonal planes. And it was the first, in fact, as I mentioned, we actually studied back in 95. And we do basically the same kind of experiments, creep experiment, elastic jump, creep, elastic unloading, and delayed recovery. And we extract an elastic modulus, which happened to be around 20,000 Pascal. And here's the story is becoming quite different. And in this system, we also have some strong hints of the interest of studying metallurgy, and more precisely fracture, to understand the onset of shear banding. But the simple view of a plateau associated with a structural transition breaks down. This is the flow curve. And in this flow curve, I will discuss separately the green points and the blue points. And the green points here, as you see, are incredibly and ridiculously small values in the shear rate. So I will explain, why do I obtain this? What confidence you can have? But basically, the easy points to obtain are these ones for shear rates on four order of magnitude, almost five order of magnitude. And since the thing that I didn't mention, all our structural data are obtained under constant applied shear rate, we were only able to investigate the structure in this region, okay? So I will discuss this first. So it is a shear thinning behavior due to the fact that you are you have five order of magnitudes in shear rate here, and you're going only between 400 and 1,000 Pascal. So it's clearly strongly shear thinning, but it's not a plateau at all. Okay, and in fact, in this system, the layer sliding mechanism is quite simple. When you look at high shear rates, you see the dense 1-1-1 plane, that is the FCC crystal is just a stacking of hexagonal planes, one above each other. And in this region, what you have is all these hexagonal planes aligned with the shear plane, with the quet walls, and sliding past each other. The subtle point is that you lose, actually, in the case of the BCC, the transition from the polycrystal to the layer sliding was not a structural transition, it was a textural transition. Because in fact, in the layer sliding regime, you keep locally the BCC geometry. Here, you are losing the FCC geometry. In fact, what you obtain is a random close packing of hexagonal planes. Okay. So this is organization of high shear rates. And for the lowest shear rates we're able to achieve at the SRF, what you observe is the polycrystal of your FCC. So when you look in the intermediate region, as you can expect, you have a superposition of the layer sliding mechanism and the polycrystal, exactly as you have it for the BCC. But notice that this coexistence and this, let's say, this decrease of the fraction of the sample occupied by the layer sliding take place in a region of the flow curve where we have absolutely no plateau. You have a shear thinning part, but you have no kind of any kind of plateau for this. Okay? So from this going downwards to these very slow shear rates, what you do is just you decrease progressively the amount of the sample which is in the layer sliding. And at first sight, we thought that in this ridge, for these first blue points, you had no more layer sliding at all. That is, we had a polycrystal flowing. But that's not what we think now. And to argue in this direction, I will come back to the green point, explain how do I obtain them, and show some things we think are quite important in the transient. Okay, a question I addressed from the beginning is it possible to obtain a stationary line for long times on these creep curves? These are typical creep curves. And for this BCC system, FCC system, sorry, it's very difficult to be convinced that in fact you are reaching a steady state. If you're waiting long enough, you're somewhat convinced, but I remain a little bit dubious about these points. And there's one, if you believe in the Maxwell plus Voigt description I gave you before, we tried to do some fancy thing, which is to take the relaxation, invert it, and subtract it. And if you believe in some kind of Voigt or Voigt-like thing plus a Maxwell, if you subtract the relaxation, you expect to see only the viscous part. And it works not too bad. You get a constant slope, and these are the points from this leftmost part of the curve. Okay, but they do not obey gamma dot 1/3. They do obey something like gamma dot 1/2, but let's say I would not comment on that. I'm not sure this is the right way of obtaining steady state, but I would argue that the system is not always slowing down to a zero slope. That's what I would argue. And one thing which is very interesting in the system is what happens just at the transition between the green and the blue points, and that's the last point I want to make. If you are just at a stress, the typical value here is 300 Pascal, if you are at a stress just above this value, what the system does is, this is a creep curve for 18 hours. And what the system does, it creeps, it seems to reach a constant slope, which is this point. But after 18 hours, it changes mind. And the system turns, there's an abrupt there's the onset of an acceleration of the system, and it jumps to this organization. And what we think is that this is a nucleation of the first layer sliding. We don't see it at the X-rays, but we think that we are actually seeing is the mechanical signature of the onset of the layer sliding on very, very few planes. Okay, and of course this waiting time decreases as you increase the stress above this value. Okay, sorry. Somewhat. Yes, it is rather reproducible. I think the problem is we didn't do many experiments for the very long ones, so it was worth a further study, I think. But this is a curve. What is very reproducible is the total deformation which is reached by the system when this event occurs. The total strain is around 40%, which is somewhat related to the strain you will need to have to get a plane just, you know, at the top of the hill before going down to the next valley. I don't know if this is really important, but this is quite reproducible. And these are the waiting times increasing as you decrease the stress. And our bigger data are for 305 Pascal. I have made an experiment at 290, but in 1 week I could not obtain the rheometer for more than 1 week, and in 1 week the system didn't make any transition to this new sliding regime. And to conclude, this was for us the first hint that there was something to think about to relate the onset of shear banding and the localization of deformation in condensed system like that with the fracture in metals. Because people in metallurgy have been studying this kind of curve for a long time. These data are not very beautiful because this region is not enhanced, and I have found here in the book in the library more beautiful data, but basically the kind of creep curve we observe have the same qualitative features as a creep curve for metal at high temperature. People in metallurgy are discussing primary, secondary, and ternary so-called creep. The first primary creep is this, which is very difficult to see here, is this first curved part, which people used to describe with a power law, T power 1/3. There is this secondary regime, which is almost linear, and metallurgists have been discussing for a long time to know if this is a steady state or not, and exactly the same problem I was discussing with the FCC phase. And then the metals undergoes a transition to a third part of the creep, which leads to fracture. That is, the system just breaks down. And of course, which is we must be careful in comparing the experiments. In these experiments, you are having a bar and you screw it or hold it down like that. So I'm not sure it completely applies, but it strongly suggests that the onset of Scherbanning in these dense systems is closely related to the fracture in metals. That is, a metal, when it fractures, it's the end of the story for a metal, of course. But in our system, some kind of fracture-like event happens, and in the fractured region of, I don't know the structure of this region, but the system is able to organize in a new structure, which is exactly the Scherbanning one. So there seems to be some kind of, and these ideas of structure appear quite naturally if you think about strong shear thinning and the onset of strong shear thinning, but quite interestingly, for example, in another completely unrelated system, which is a transient network of telekinetic polymers, which is completely disordered without any kind of crystalline order, we are going, and after work we've been done by Jean-François, and on these kind of systems, we are coming to think on this system also of the onset of Scherbanning and the nucleation of the first layer in terms of fracture. And I think this is certainly one of the most challenging aspects of Scherbanning in dense systems, and even in disordered non-so-dense systems, is how does the system manage to localize the deformation under an applied stress above some critical stress. And in our case, in my case, it was on this system that I had the first idea that there could be some correlation between the onset of Scherbanning and some kind of a fracture. Okay, so I think I'm done.
You talk about Scherbanning in the soft crystalline systems, but from the structure of the observatory, there are also proof that there's shear bands. So what is called shear
bands? There are some, yes. If you look at the structure factors I've shown here, as I mentioned, you can scan the gap. You can do it. You can have this evidence from two kind of observations. You can monitor the relative age of the peaks of the ordered and the crystalline phase. And you see that you go through both, of course, but the relative age of the peak gives you some kind of ratio of the two, but it doesn't give you any localization, I agree. But if you go in the gap, you can scan in the gap from the inner to the external part. And for example, something which is quite nice is that we always obtain the onset of the new fluid phase near the inner bulb of the quiet cell, where we know the stress is higher.
Very different
there. Yeah.
The band doesn't move?
No, it nucleates on the inner bulb and then grow. Oh, well, this, I mean, the whole question of the interface between the bands is in a very rough state. I mean, we think we can argue that there are coexistence between two bands, but if you want to study very precisely where the interface is or which is moving, this needs further study than we did. Okay, so Peter, if it's going to enter. Yeah. The control, exactly. Okay. So the reason why I don't want to discuss it too much because these points correspond to a decreasing part of the stress versus the shear rate, as you noticed, suddenly.
Yes, but the explanation
is that bending in the more distant direction. Yes, but we didn't see that. Well, you know, it's SRF, you can do that.
Exactly,
the ground signal is that you can have sigma 1 for the material above and sigma 2 for the material below.
And, you,
and, they're, and they're flowing at the same strain rate, which is set by a cylinder, and it's homogeneous in the gradient direction, then this would be consistent with when I brought decrease in the flow mm-hmm. and stress in the flow curve. If you start off, say, in phase one, you get to a point, you nucleate phase two, mm-hmm. and then you get a decrease.
Yeah.
And that's in the simplest case. Now, you can get it to, if you have another order parameter inside, which is conserved, which is like concentration, you can actually get steady state flow curves, which would be have a negative slope, but they're actually, they would be stable because they're a composite flow.
Yeah. So, concerning experimentally.
Shear bending your surface just the other direction.
Absolutely.
No, you didn't show it in bending in the other direction.
You mean in the gradient? Yes. In the hexagonal, yes, we think there is also.
You showed it after you turned it off.
But we think that the part which recrystallized, perfectly aligned with the walls, was the molten part. So it's a non-very direct argument, but let's say...
Have you looked in knots?
Yeah, we have looked because from time to time we are worried that we are always sending the X-rays on the same part of the sample, so we just change the height. And we have never been able to observe a difference in structure, a significant difference in structure, a systematic difference in structure from this, but we have not been looking specifically to that. Okay, you do a control shear rate experiment on a rheometer, which is a controlled stress rheometer. So it means that on this controlled stress rheometer, you have the software which enables you to obtain this to monitor. Controlled shear rate and increasing the shear rate. One after the other, increasing the shear rate. So it's we are not carefully selecting one shear rate and waiting for the transient and all that. In this case, not. We did it. We were more careful with the control stress to check that if the transients were okay with the kind of experiments we did. But for the shear rate control, we were not convinced from the beginning, so we didn't look very carefully. Because we knew that the very idea of doing a controlled shear rate experiment on this rheometer could be misleading. I mean, I don't know, but we were not really looking very carefully at that.
Do you have a hypothesis requiring those casts?
We did not do that on zoological experiments. What Laurence did is to visualize the crystallite boundaries on a few to get an idea of the size of the crystallites in this. But we didn't do it to prepare the sample before any stress experiment. Well, we could do that because Laurence now knows how to do that carefully, and she had some nice pictures of crystallites under the microscope, but not in terms of trying to induce some kind of defects in the look. And of course, you try to localize this. I'm not sure exactly what should be done to change. We can discuss about that. But we could do that. We could try to do it. But it's not clear in my mind. Oh, you should do it to get reliable results. Okay.
Question concerning that region where polycrystalline substance flows, stress is either proportional to shear rate, either 1/3 or maybe 1/2 of the other. We have this argument leading to the 1/3 with the dislocations, which is very convincing. On the other hand, we have seen similar problems in computer simulation systems where there was definitely no chance to have something like this. The dislocation would be much more unpleasant. The question I have is, if you start from the polygrid, one can think about, in terms of grains, and there are regions between the grains, the villages will discuss this subject. So you could have a flow where it's more the motion of single grains or something before
you
go to the layer, or before you have.
But you're right, absolutely. There is still the fact that this the width of the it boils down to discussing what means the width of the peak I have shown going as gamma at 1/3. You can I have rather given an interpretation in terms of distance between these locations, but to also discuss it in terms of average size of the grains, which would become smaller. But of course, grain boundaries, except for small disorientations, grain boundaries themselves are composed of dislocations in these systems. So,
anyway, that's more at least 1/3 power doesn't mean that some other models don't have the same power.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I will not argue that there is only the glide of dislocations. Some elements seem to gather that, indicating that this. This mechanism can play an important role, but I agree that, there's a nice paper I found in the library, an extract of an address of Orwan to the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, in which he says that a polycrystal is something very complicated, and the kind of analysis where people are trying to do, which are very fancy from the mathematical point of view, is a little bit equivalent to taking a watch and submitting it to a stress-strain curve, which certainly he said would be very interesting, and trying to draw elaborate conclusions from this curve, and afterward dissolving the watch in its chemicals and trying to do some fancy correlations. It's very, very complicated, of course. In fact, he says the polycrystal is more complicated than a watch. That's another, it depends on how you define complexity, of course, but our understanding is very, very, very crude, of course. In particular, what I like to do is discuss with people who came in our lab recently is to try to visualize dislocations, and people are able to do that, apparently. You can do things that you cannot do on metals, for example. Could be. I know. I cannot tell. No. But for example, when you nucleate the first bands of layer sliding, one naive picture you can have, the grain boundaries, because of the argument you just said, perhaps will be places where, you have a disordered system, and you can think of course, as grain boundaries as weak points, randomly distributed. And this is not an easy problem. You take an elastic material with weak parts distributed, you submit it to a stress, and there seems to be some localization of the deformation at a given moment. And of course, you can naively think that the grain boundaries are weak parts, there are some kind of percolation of weak parts of grain boundaries due to reorganizations. This would be another way to think about these systems, but my ideas are completely fuzzy about that. I don't know. We'll find it. Is with layer sliding. Even a small amount that we cannot see with the X-rays. Dislocations moving in our interpretation.
And if your frame could be
I mean, you mean under applied shear rate? Under constant stress, you will not, of course, you will never see that because you have a transition from one mechanism to the other from the same stress. Oh, you mean this is below this one, yeah. You mean a gap in stress? The gap in shear rate. Yes, and the gap in shear rate is just that when you measure this part, when you take a linear fit of this part, you will never go beyond this point. You must nucleate this new organization to get there. Yeah. Yeah. But is yeah, and this point, I know the points on the blue curve are stationary points in that sense that you can go up and down. These are the real No. You extrapolate to yeah. I must look back to this. Let's see. When you decrease the stress, when you decrease the stress, let me think back. It's a rather old data. What is happening when you? Well, for sure, okay. Up to this point, you are still in the blue curve, and when you decrease the stress, right? No, I must look back. I don't remember what happened in this case. For concerning what happens when you go back in stress from the blue curve, no, I don't remember. Oh yes, oh yes. I mean, so the green point depends if you believe in the kind of manipulation of the data I've been doing. Sorry? Yeah, but you know, nevertheless, this is an 18 hours experiment, and you can, here you have some kind of straight slope, but you have a reasonable value for an effective shear rate. Well, yeah, I can put it back. It's roughly the same as the one for the BCC. That is, you have this increase in G double prime and decrease in G prime, something around 0.1 second minus 1. And we did not look very much closely.
Do you believe that pseudo linear, in a sense, obviously you can't give a real linear limit to this curve?
I cannot say. I'd say the data are not very clean, and I would say it's not a beautiful Maxwell peak, and we have more tendency to think that the G double prime continue to increase, and of course from the structure of the material, which is dense with disorder at the levels of grain boundaries and polycrystallinity, we would expect it to be some kind of to have some kind of aging behavior. And Luca Cipolletti in our lab has done some dynamic leg scattering on this system, and he has observed some kind of aging behavior with the waiting time being the only typical time in the system, which is quite reasonable if you think about the growth of crystallites in very long times. This whole problem is worthy further study. I mean, I will not say much more about it.
If you're back along, I'm wondering what the relationship between these cubic systems is and other continuous cubic phase from igniting air. With very similar symmetries to that with phase BPC one example.
Yeah.
Which also has strain energy, not at least for a number of years, but I wonder if you can tell us whether these are in the same class or whether there's a
Concerning, I don't know what people have studied concerning the shear banding transitions in these curves. I'm not aware of this work. I don't know if you do you.
Some of the linear, the weakly nonlinear stuff may be is where it's certainly wrong with the thing.
Okay.
A closer related question. Have you ever varied the strain rate at all on the linear viscoelastic measurements? What happens in the melt systems is that the inherent position of the peak continues to shift down. Until you leave the frequency range, it would decrease.
You mean in the oscillatory experiment, in the linear rheology?
Yeah.
Right. Yes. I see the argument, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It is possible that you have some tiny, tiny yield stress.
Well, certainly there is. Yeah, I think certainly there is, because as the experiment with the child I was mentioning, there is certainly some kind of a yield stress in the system.
Yeah, so the story with the BCC melts was that Bates and Farley and Minnesota did oscillatory measurements and showed that that the peak would shift down to the bottom of the frequency range on that rheometer as he reduced the strain to a 0.5%, which is a limiting measurement.
Yeah.
When Register looked on much more sensitive creep measurements, where you could put only a few tens of pascal on the system, he eventually got a viscous behavior.
Okay.
But at much, much lower stresses.
Okay, that's nice.
And with the child's finger, did you make a dent, or you just
Rest? I think I should speak like that. It makes a dent, and so you have this kind of thing. You put it down, and it's elastic, so it's a viscoelastic, so it makes what you call a dent, I think, which is a small peak, which is still here. Sorry? Why is it? 1 centimeter?
You see, if it's a centimeter.
A centimeter, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're right, yes. Perhaps I have not looked quite closely, but he has slightly get down.
That is a compression.
Yeah.
steel.
Yeah.
Question about the implications of this 40% strain. So you said that if you applied a creep test at just above 300 Pascal,
yeah.
Which system is that?
The F10, the FCC one.
The FCC one. That when it got to 40%, around 40% strain, it would appear to nucleate the second less.
Yeah, I mean, in all the data we have on these creep tests, one thing which is reproducible is not really the time, as the question was asked, but the total deformation at which, roughly speaking, the transition occurs. I mean, when you reach a total deformation of around 40%, this is a good sign that you are going to begin the transition to the new flow behavior, which we associate with layer sliding. Yeah. Yeah. But we have no good fit of the data in this region. I mean, we don't know exactly which kind of low. I mentioned you can see it as Maxwell plus Voigt, but it doesn't fit. In fact, it's more complicated than that. So. Yes. No. And you mean there's a constant in the Orwell law to obtain the mobility of the dislocation? Yeah, but yes. No, we didn't try because we don't know the mobility. Well, just to obtain the mobility. To obtain the mobility, yes. No, we didn't try that.